61, side 1, house fiduciary, subcommittee 3, maintenance at 39, 8:30 a.m., room 350, hearing and work session at council, 2969, Senate Bill 106, and Senate Bill 107.
The House Subcommittee on Judiciary, number 3, will come to order. Clerk will note those present, the remainder excused. We have before us this morning House Bill 2969, Senate Bill 106, and Senate Bill 107 for hearing and possible work session. Senator Meeker, would you like to testify?
Chairman, my name is Tony Meeker, Senate District 15. My purpose in being here this morning is to introduce you to the Task Force on Juvenile Corrections and some of the activities of that task force. You have on your agenda today two bills that are here from the task force. In 1975, when the legislature created the Task Force on the Corrections, the task force took on the task of studying the problem of crime and its impact on the community in the state of Oregon. Very quickly learned that it had really two jobs ahead of it, adult corrections and juvenile corrections. Made the decision not to take on both and address the most important problem first, which ended up being the adult correction situation with the state penitentiary at an overflow position. They made a recommendation to the legislature, and the legislature followed through with it in 1977 by creating the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Corrections. Oregon has the highest or the second highest commitment rates to its juvenile detention facilities in the nation. It also has one of the highest juvenile crime rates in the nation. Hillcrest and McLaren are at capacity. With those kinds of data before the task force, a thorough examination of the process and the system handling juveniles in Oregon was taken up. There are quite a number of bills that were introduced on the Senate side, pre-filed. Most of them have passed the Senate or are in the Ways and Means Committee. You have two before you today. The thrust of this legislation is to simplify the system or to plug holes in the system that have created some of our problems. The attempt is to provide more flexibility in the system, some alternatives to the system so that we can do something about this overcrowding of institutions, a lack of resources at the local level, and to assist the system in handling young people. Now, I'm not going to go through the list of horror stories that were brought to the task force about how the system works. You have with you today a juvenile court judge who has firsthand experience with the system. Our task force was made up of a wide variety of people, Children's Services Division, juvenile court directors, judges, lay citizens, people from the child care agencies, and legislators. I commend the report to you. If you want to take the time to read it at this point in the session, it may be something you put on the back burner. We have staff available in Lee Penny, who was the executive director of the task force, who can provide you with the nuts and bolts kind of responses to questions you might ask.
Questions? Tony, the 106 provides for detention for up to 14 days under certain circumstances. Did the task force give some consideration to what kinds of facilities that detention might take place in?
The task force didn't look at the did look at the detention question. We did not get involved in the statutory circumstances that require sight and sound separation. We discussed it some, but we felt that was an issue that was a separate issue. We looked more at the process and how the process works rather than getting into facilities questions. The law already requires sight and sound. The law already requires 72 hours for status offenders. We didn't get into those kind of questions. We made the assumption that the law was being carried out on sight and sound, and that the purpose of Senate Bill 106, and by the way, let me tell you that the task force recommended 14 straight days of detention availability in their original bill. The Senate amended it some. I would recommend that you take a look not only at the amended version but the original bill. If you'd like me to explain the purpose behind that bill, I'd be glad to do that.
Oh, I think I understand that. I just was trying to determine if it was going to require counties to build separate facilities.
No, I don't believe it does.
Big fiscal impact to it.
In that regard, there is a bill in the Ways and Means Committee that deals with that question, providing funds for solving some of their problems at the county level in the form of upgraded detention.
I guess the other question is, even if they have the facilities now, do they have insufficient numbers to accommodate the people that you might expect to be incarcerated as a result of the bill?
Well, we had no estimates or numbers available or given to us in regards to how many children were going to be used in this, or that how many facilities would be required for the functions of this bill. I think it'll be minimal. I look at the bill as a tool, to the juvenile court judge in handling problem children. I don't look at it with that it would be a great deal of impact. I think that the facilities are there to handle the current situation.
Do you have any questions, Representative? Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
For coming in today. Judge Norblad, would you like to come up, please?
My name is Al Norblad. I'm a domestic relations juvenile judge from Marion County, and I'd like to speak in regards to Senate Bill 106. I think the concept is good, and I certainly support it. I support it in the original task force aspect, which was 14 straight days. Under the Senate version, it's been changed to 8 days or 4 weekends. I don't think this is good. It's my understanding that the theory this was changed to weekends was based upon the theory that the child or the adolescent was in school, and if he was placed in detention, it would affect his schooling. I would say at least 60% of the children that I deal with are out of school for some reason or another, and those that I would be using Senate Bill 106 for, and those children that really give me a lot of trouble are just not one-timers, are those that are not in school. And I think we're probably looking closer to 90% of the children who would be affected by this bill are ones not in school. So I don't think this is a good and valid argument. The other thing that bothers me is immediacy is very, very important to children. If you try to have consequences for an act that was done 30 days ago or something of this nature, it becomes exceptionally difficult and they're not able to relate back. So I think we need immediacy and consequences sooner, and that the weekend is really not going to work. And if you have a child that's a runaway, out of control, and you can't find him, and let's say you decide on a Monday that he should serve a period of time in detention, how you're going to chase him down to find him Friday night, God only knows. The other thing, and I think just the general concept of this bill, is we have to have some kind of consequences in the community. You can give us all the money, all the other laws and everything to help kids in the community, but unless we can make some kind of consequences to make them work in the community, community service really is not going to work. It's going to be a failure. And I think, I know I've got the highest commitment rate in the state of Oregon, and I think one of the reasons for it is I find that I have no, there are no consequences in the community or ways to get the children to go along with programs, work in programs in the community, and I do need that. And so I support the bill, but I don't think that weekends is going to be particularly effective. I think it should be 8 days straight or 14 days straight.
You mentioned two concepts there that I'd like to ask you about. First of all, with respect to the weekend, would you not think that the judge would be aware if the child was in school and could take that into account in connection with sentencing?
Sure, sure. No doubt about it.
Okay, the other thing, this alternative service that you're talking about, that doesn't seem to be addressed in the bill. Did you want, were you suggesting that the committee should make some recommendations with respect to alternative?
No, there are other bills and there are existing laws which allow for alternative community service programs in the community. All I'm suggesting is with 106, with my having a hammer or consequences if you don't follow through on those programs in the community, that I should be able to keep more children in the community with this type of bill with either 8 or 14 days straight. Frankly, I don't even think that I would use the full 8 or 14. I can't conceive of a case where I would. But as a practical matter, the thing that concerns me is I need the immediacy, not the weekends. And I think that's very, very important.
Okay. Question? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Lee Penny?
I'm Lee Penny, Project Director of the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Corrections. I think you have already heard what most of the background on this bill is. It was adopted by the task force at the request of several of the juvenile court judges who wanted another alternative to enforce their court orders, short of having to remove the child from his home, send him to training school or other out-of-home placement. It was amended in the Senate, as you know, from 14 days to 8 days served on weekends. The detention, this type of detention would be confined to those counties which have a facility which provides sight and sound separation, which is staffed by juvenile department personnel. The Senate also placed a sunset provision on it so they can check in the next session to see how it's working, how it's being used. Whether it needs revision. Child would be placed in detention under these circumstances only pursuant to a court hearing. I think that's probably sufficient.
Lee, what was the reason that the time was changed from 14 to 8 days?
It was, as Judge Norblad explained, there was concern on the part of some of the Senate members that if children were attending school and were placed in detention for 14 days, particularly if they were a marginal student to begin with, and many of these children are, child might not return to school. It might only encourage dropping out.
Did the committee not believe that the judge would take that into account?
That particular subject wasn't discussed in detail. There were also, of course, there are a lot of these children out of school. Some of them do have jobs. It was a concern about disruption of the child's life that might be counterproductive to them. But that was their reason for changing.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Did you want to testify on 107 while you were here too, Lee?
Right. the 1959 juvenile code provided for the sight and sound separation of children from adults in juvenile or in adult facilities, and prohibited placing children under the age of 14 in jail. In fact, the separation of children and adults dates from Oregon's first juvenile law, which was passed in 1905. The minimum age was adopted in 1907. There are, however, several counties and city lockups in the state which have never come into conformance with the sight and sound separation requirements when adult inmates are present. Nor has there ever been inspection or enforcement procedure for these laws. Senate Bill 107 would give this inspection and enforcement obligation to the jail inspections team, which is going into the jails periodically in any event, and they would add to that the juvenile detention facilities and the state juvenile homes. Enforcement would be in the same manner as that used for adult jails. There would be recommendations for compliance with standards, and that failing, a request would be made to the Attorney General to initiate appropriate legal action.
So at the present time, they're not being inspected, and this would provide...
No, except on an informal basis by the jail inspections team. The information we have on noncompliance comes from Mr. Black of the jail inspections team, but he does this simply in passing as he is inspecting jails for adult standards. There's no enforcement procedure.
Have the cities and counties, I assume they've been heard on this issue, and did they have a position on it?
Well, I think there is not reluctance on anyone's part, I think, to come into conformance. It's a monetary matter. Some counties have gone to some expense to conform with the law. Others have not. There is a bill, Senate Bill 126, also from the task force now on Ways and Means, which would provide some funds to counties to help them come into compliance. That certainly, I think, some concern was expressed with counties because of the financial impact, but as a matter of fact, it is an their obligation now and has been... well, actually, since 1905, this would simply provide an inspection and enforcement machinery that has always been missing from that state.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions, Joe? Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
House Bill 2969, George Snyder.
Right now, I'm the administrator of the Business and Consumer Affairs Committee in the House, but have been a lawyer in private practice, and it's in that connection that this bill arises. First, let me just briefly describe the bill. It would simply provide in mandamus proceedings that where the mandamus defendant is a judge of district court in his capacity as such, that the jurisdiction would be in the Court of Appeals. To put this in the proper focus, let me briefly review the history, first of all, of appeals from final judgments in terms of the courts in Oregon. Before the 69 session, of course, we just had the three courts of District, Circuit, and Supreme, and you'd appeal from the Circuit Court to the Supreme Court, from the District Court to the Circuit Court, possibly on to the Supreme Court after that. Then in 69 we got the Court of Appeals, and the change that was made there was with respect to appeals from final judgments in the Circuit Court, that some would go to the Court of Appeals and some would go to the Supreme Court. then 75, we got the rule that now all appeals from district courts will go to the Court of Appeals, and finally, last session, we got the rule that all appeals from circuit court would go to the Court of Appeals. So to sum it up, in terms of appeals from final judgments, first of all, the situation right now is that you have appeal as of right from either district or circuit court going to the Court of Appeals. Then you have discretionary review afterwards in the Supreme Court. As I'm sure you're aware, the rules of the Supreme Court on petition for review and rehearing of a Court of Appeals decision require you to state a statement of concrete reasons apart from those asserted for reversal, explaining why the issues presented have importance beyond the particular case and require a decision by the Supreme Court. So you've got a discretionary level from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. Now, I'd like to turn to interlocutory appeals, which is where mandamus comes in, and to focus this, just give you a specific example of an out-of-state defendant sued in Oregon under the long-arm statute. And the question is, let's say, whether the defendant was transacting business within Oregon. Could be one of a number of questions in long-arm, but let's say that's the one. So he files a motion to quash service of summons, and that's denied by the trial court. At this point, he petitions for mandamus in the Supreme Court, and this procedure is very well recognized. You have, in 68, you have State X. Rel. White Lumber Company versus Solmanetti, and then just last June, you have Academy Press, State X. Rel. Academy Press versus Beckett. The procedure is quite clearly recognized. And the point is, in terms of judicial economy, perhaps not so much judicial economy, but certainly economy for the point of view of the litigants, if the trial judge has in fact made an error in denying this motion to quash service and summons, and there's no way to correct it before trial, well, let me put it the other way around. If it is corrected before trial, then the defendant has been spared the expense of coming to Oregon to defend the trial. It's true that it's open to the defendant to raise it on appeal when the case is all over, but obviously there's a great difference in making him defend when, by hypothesis, he shouldn't have had to defend at all. Okay. So, putting it in that context, then, very briefly, the history of mandamus. Before the 69th session, you have, if the mandamus defendant is a circuit court judge, then it's in the Supreme Court, clearly. If the mandamus defendant is a district court judge, then it's in the circuit court with possibly an appeal to the Supreme Court as to what the circuit court did with the mandamus. Now, in 69, then, again, the Court of Appeals comes in, and there's no change made. In 75, when we have the change that says appeals from final judgments of district court go to the Court of Appeals, again, there's no change made. Now, there well could have been, because this is, as I say, this mandamus, as an interlocutory appeal, would have been quite logical in 75 to have said that both the appeals from final judgment and interlocutory appeals go to the Court of Appeals, but this didn't happen. As near as I can figure out, and as near as the Court of Appeals in a case that I'll mention in a second could figure out, the question simply didn't come up in 75. Okay, then last session you have, again, when the change is made that now all appeals from circuit or district court go to the Court of Appeals, still, there's nothing said about mandamus. So, in 78, we get the case of Hoffman versus French, which was decided by the Court of Appeals, and that says it's dictum in that case, but there's another case that follows it up that says holds the point squarely. Hoffman versus French, in effect, says that you no longer can file mandamus against the district court judge in circuit court. The reasoning being that you've got the 75 amendments that said appeals from the district court go to the Court of Appeals instead of the circuit court, as previously been the case. Therefore, the reasoning goes the district court is no longer an inferior court to the circuit court, and you cannot have a mandamus against something that's not an inferior court. that was actually squarely held in Matilla versus Mason this year, because Hoffman versus French is actually a writ of review case, but they do mention mandamus. That, incidentally, is how I happened to get interested in the problem, because I had a case in my office, and believe it or not, my conclusion was, based on Hoffman versus French, which is kind of a mysterious opinion in some places, that I had to, it was a case of filing mandamus against the district court judge, and I actually wound up filing that in the circuit court for Multnomah County and the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, because I couldn't be sure that I wasn't leaving out the right one. Be that as it may, the situation now then is that you're talking about appeals from final judgments, either of the district court or of the circuit court. They both go to the Court of Appeals. But if you're talking about interlocutory appeals by way of mandamus, again, either from the district court or the circuit court, they go to the Supreme Court, because there's just no provision as it stands now for mandamus jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals. Because, as I say, it came in 69, the Court of Appeals came in 69, but there's never been any change in the law relating to mandamus. Now, there are two aspects to why the law should be changed, it seems to me. One is just simply a matter of symmetry. Let me just read you two sentences out of Amgur Second, and this is talking about states in general, of course. Although the jurisdiction conferred upon courts of last review to issue writs of mandamus may in certain instances be made exclusive, this is not ordinarily the case. Notwithstanding the jurisdiction of the higher court in the matter, the lower courts are not usually deprived of a like power to issue the writ, nor the legislature prevented from expressly or impliedly authorizing them to do so. So, on the symmetry point, it's simply a matter of if we're going to have appeals from final judgments go to the Court of Appeals, as a matter of policy, it's clearly been thrashed out in previous sessions and decided at this point that that's the way it should be. Why should we have interlocutory appeals going to the Supreme Court? Beyond that, the second point, though, is a more practical one, and that is got to do with the fact that it's clear in the Constitution, in Article 7, Section 2, of the Constitution, that the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court in mandamus is discretionary. And discretionary in this sense, mandamus is inherently discretionary if you're talking about the question of whether to issue the writ or deny it. But it's discretionary in the sense that the Supreme Court can, and I have personally had experience with this, say, we don't want to hear this case at this time at all. We're not going to entertain the case, and which, you know, they can do because the point can still be raised on appeal. The point, they're not saying that you never have a chance to raise this. They're just saying that go ahead, go to trial, in my case of the out-of-state defendant and so forth, which is another actual case of mine. Go ahead, go to trial, and then if you're appealing, one of your points on appeal can be, I never should have been here in the first place, and we'll listen to it at that time, and we'll decide, or the Court of Appeals, actually, maybe ultimately the Supreme Court. But we are not going to entertain the question here, so we're not even going to give you a decision on the question, the merits of whether mandamus should issue or not. Now, this perhaps is appropriate if you think of the informal distinction between the Court of Appeals as an error-correcting court, with that being its basic role, and the Supreme Court as a policy-making court. But it seems to me that there should be a court where you can get a decision on the merits. Again, the case of the out-of-state defendant arguably should not have to be in court here in Oregon, and taking the time and money to try the case, and of course it tends to coerce a settlement if they've lost on the motion to quash, and then they go up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, well, we don't want to hear the case at this time. So then they're back and they're facing the trial. Maybe they've got a good point, but it's going to be after the trial's over and then an appeal before they're going to be able to raise it. There is a question, I'm sorry to say, in the bill at this point. The way that it's drafted, and I hadn't seen this at first, but I have it written that the Court of Appeals shall have jurisdiction in all cases. Well, I think that's open to debate as to whether the intention is that the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals is discretionary in the same sense that the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is, or whether you have mandamus to the Court of Appeals as of right. That is, they've got to give you a decision on whether mandamus should issue. I think it's easy enough to change it if the desire be to make it clear that it should be discretionary, like the Supreme Court. We would simply say the Court of Appeals shall have discretionary jurisdiction. Just insert that one word. I would favor the other solution, the other decision on the question. I would favor a policy decision that says that you have mandamus in the Court of Appeals as of right, and to make that clear, you would change the words shall have to must take. So it would say the Court of Appeals must take jurisdiction in all cases, so forth, and that would, I think it would be even more clear when you realize that's juxtaposed to the next clause that says the Supreme Court may take original jurisdiction. So I suppose that it needs to be changed one way or the other, just to be, so we don't have a litigation about what was intended in terms of discretionary jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals. And that's a policy question, but my preference is what I've just stated. Two other quick points. The bill, in its present form, addresses only the case of a district court judge as a mandamus defendant. The reason that's so is that that is the specific question that I was presented with, and that's really the thing I was thinking about. But everything I've said is just as logical, it seems to me, if you're talking about a circuit court judge as the mandamus defendant, because in either case, you have a trial-level judge, the only, and one's not inferior to the other. You have, of course, the different jurisdictional amounts, above and below 3,000. But the district court is no longer inferior. That's been held in Hoffman versus French. And if it makes sense that mandamus against a district court judge should lie in the Court of Appeals, it makes every bit of sense that should be true when you're talking about a circuit court judge as well. And that, in fact, I've got an amendment prepared on that. Simply inserts the word circuit or before district. So it would read judge of a circuit or district court. The last point, you may have some questions on this aspect of it, if you do, fine, but since I had this bill put in, I've gotten to talking with two legal aid attorneys who are familiar with this problem in the writ of review context, actually, but it's come to my attention that there are some policy considerations. If you're talking now just about a district court judge, there are some policy considerations that would arguably favor returning the situation to what it was prior to the 75 amendments as construed by Hoffman versus French, and that is putting mandamus jurisdiction in the circuit court, back into the circuit court, where you're talking about a district court judge as the mandamus defendant. Now, that's not this bill exactly. This bill could very easily be the vehicle for that. but there are policy considerations, and Mike Taylor and Ken Ryder are in the audience to take up that point. If you have any questions on what I've already said, I'll be happy to answer them now or later.
Okay, so as I understand it, this arose out of a case that you had, and you simply want to clarify where the jurisdiction lay. Is that correct?
That's how it initially got started. That's correct.
But it is a matter of clarification. There's not any other policy reason that you arrived at.
Well, I wouldn't say it's simply a matter of clarification at this point, because although I think the wording of Hoffman versus French is quite confusing, and as I say, it led me as your average practitioner to file in three different places. It's on appeal to the Supreme Court right now. The Supreme Court has heard argument. In fact, it's Ken Ryder's case, and he has argued it before the Supreme Court. There'll be a decision probably, and if it's not clear now, I think about the 10th or 15th time that I read it, I began to see what Judge Johnson was actually saying. So you might say that the situation is clear, or it's about to become clear, but I don't think that's all there is to the problem, because I wouldn't be happy if, suppose the Supreme Court says that the Court of Appeals is right, and therefore, the situation on mandamus is that if you're talking about a district court judge defendant, that it comes here to the Supreme Court with our discretionary jurisdiction, and that's it. It can go no place else now. It can't go to the Court of Appeals because it's never been there. It can't go to the Circuit Court because Hoffman versus French is right. And, of course, same thing is true of Circuit Court. There's never been any question about that. If that's what the Supreme Court said, I wouldn't be happy, because while it'd be clear, you would be in the situation that I've actually experienced of having, this is a New York client, they were sued in Oregon. I think that, and I filed a motion to quash in Multnomah County Circuit Court, which was denied, and I took it up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court did not give me a ruling on the merits. The Supreme Court said, you know, we're not going to take jurisdiction. We're exercising our discretion not to take jurisdiction. Now, I can, depending on how the case goes, if we go to trial and we lose and we appeal, I can raise that point. But I can testify from personal experience that the decision so far is tending to coerce a settlement. Well, settlements are to be favored, I guess, but if it's really true, and I think it really is true, that the judge made a mistake in saying that this defendant had transacted business in Oregon, it seems to me I ought to be able to have that issue aired someplace, and if I'm right, then no trial and no coming from New York to Oregon. So
did you talk to the judicial conference or the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court judges with respect to that? Do you know what their position is on?
I talked to Dave Gernand, the counsel for the court, and he, I guess, was not in a position to express an opinion one way or another about it. He said that he was interested in the bill, and depending on what the committee seemed to want to do, why, well, I don't know that some time ago, and I can't recall if he said that the judges might take a position at that time or not, but I touched that base, but not otherwise.
John, would you send a letter to Gernant with the bill, and also Judge Beatty, and invite comments of either of them if they have comments? They don't need to feel compelled to comment if they don't care, but I'd like to know if they have some thoughts on it. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Snyder, for coming in.
Did you want to hear on the, I guess they're signed up, actually, the other aspect?
Yes, I think Michael Taylor signed up.
Yeah.
Were you finished with your testimony?
Yes.
Thank you. you like to come forward?
Good morning. I am Michael Taylor from Legal Aid Service for Multnomah County. I've asked Ken Ryder from Marion Polk County Legal Aid, who's generally familiar with the issues that this bill raises, to come with me this morning in case there are questions and in case he wants to say something. Okay. I'll be brief. We support this bill because it fills what is now a gap in the appeals procedures. After the Court of Appeals decision in Matilla versus Mason, and I have submitted written testimony, by the way,
yes,
which I cite
these
cases. The only way that you can appeal certain kinds of errors is to go to the Supreme Court and ask that they issue their discretionary writ of mandamus. Before that decision, you at least had a shot in a district court error by going to the circuit court. But in Matilla and in the related case of Hoffman, the Court of Appeals said that you can no longer try to correct district court errors by going to the circuit court because the district court's not an inferior court anymore. The result for writ of mandamus is that the only place you can go is to the Supreme Court, and they don't have to take jurisdiction. Our office has only actually had one writ of mandamus case in the last 4.5 years that I've been able to find. Came out of what we thought was a district court error. We appealed to the circuit court through the vehicle of the writ of mandamus. Eventually, we ended up at the Supreme Court, who, in effect, overruled the district court judge. Our main criticism of 2969, and it's not so much a criticism as it is a suggestion, is it doesn't go far enough. We would like the legislature to clearly reinstate the authority of the circuit court to review decisions of the district court, both through the devices of the writ of mandamus and the writ of review. Those have been devices around for often, essentially for years, but after the two recent Court of Appeals decisions don't exist anymore, although one case is on review to the Supreme Court. So,
Michael,
yes.
I think when you send a letter that you might ask the Judicial Conference to address those proposed amendments.
Our approach is embodied in Senate Bill 788, which we have lobbied for on the Senate side. And the Judicial Conference didn't take a stand on 788. Perhaps if the committee sends a letter, perhaps not. I don't know. I don't have much more to add. If I essentially see 2969 as a kind of in-between measure between the current state of affairs and what we'd like, which is to give the circuit court powers to review the district court. At least with 2969 and a related bill, Senate Bill 816, you could go to the Court of Appeals now instead of having to go to the Supreme Court. That's basically what I've got to say today. Ken, do you want to add anything?
Just a few words. My name is Ken Ryder from Legal Aid here in Salem. The reason that this bill would be important is because since Hoffman versus French, which is a case that I did, and also the Matilla v. Mason, which applies in dicta in Hoffman to the writ of mandamus, there's really no adequate remedy for an individual litigant to have his decision reviewed if it's not an appeal. In other words, if the appeal process is inadequate, and attached to Mike's testimony, there's the case of Eichler v. Hetzel, is it? In Eichler v. Hetzel, you'll read it and you'll see that the appeal process in that case was inadequate. And if the appeal process is inadequate, then you have to have some other means of having a district court or even a circuit court decision reviewed. And the asking the Supreme Court to exercise its original jurisdiction to issue a writ of mandamus is not an adequate remedy for an individual litigant. Also, in Mr. Taylor's testimony is a blurb from the CLE, which states Stage D. Plummer. And recently, in 78, there was dictum in Bowe versus Straub,
that said that the Supreme Court has decided to take this case because of its public importance. I think what has to be considered is that when we're talking about individual litigants, where we don't have any great public importance, but there is importance for the individual, that there does have to be another means of reviewing that decision if appeal is inadequate. And I think that Eichler v. Hetzel is an excellent example of where appeal was inadequate, but writ of mandamus possibly could have been an adequate remedy. And the Supreme Court probably, just through speculation, would not have granted its original jurisdiction to issue a writ of mandamus in that case because it did not have the great public importance of a case like Bowe versus Straub, and therefore that litigant just would have had no remedy at all, which is, of course, what happened in that case. The Hoffman case is on appeal to the Supreme Court. It was argued on March 5th, but we haven't received a decision yet.
Okay, thank you.
One question. Isn't there a big writ of review bill in the Senate somewhere?
There is. That's Senate Bill 435, and it deals with writs of review, but it deals with them mostly from the point of view of land use planning, which is probably the major use of the writ of review. It does contain one section, Section 13, which has the effect of codifying the Court of Appeals decision in Hoffman versus French, and therefore by statute doing away with the use of the writ of review as a means of correcting district court errors by the circuit court.
So it would directly conflict with your proposed amendment to the extent that your amendment includes the writ of review.
I would have no proposed amendment which includes the writ of review because the relating clause to this bill says it relates to writs of mandamus.
Oh, I thought you said that you thought it didn't, the bill didn't go far enough, and I took that to be an implied suggested amendment that the bill should
get through. Okay. We're working and testifying on 435 from that end.
435 applies only to writs of review, not writs of mandamus.
Yeah,
I believe that 788 and this bill today are the only ones that relate to mandamus before the legislature this year.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else signed up to testify, or who wished to testify, I should say, on 2969? Senate Bill 106? Senate Bill 107? No one else? Not. We'll close the hearing. Since there's no quorum, we will not have a work session. That might come as a surprise. Any announcements? We'll be adjourned.